Now, the secret of journalism, known to everyone who gets caught by it, is that it is a lot of fun. And no one has had more fun with it than Hugh Lunn. Now, Hugh has won 3 Walkley Awards back in the 1970s, when there were very few Walkley Awards given out in those days.
That's right.
His books have won literary awards and been monstrously large bestsellers. And even now, in his 80s, he's still popping up to have a yarn or to push a cause or an idea. Fun, of course, in a journalistic sense, is often difficult. That is, in fact, where most of the fun is. The challenge of the work, the intense experience, the danger, the stress, with always a story to be told and hopefully a drink to be had at the end of it. Hugh Lunn, welcome.
Nice of you to have me on, Hugh. Nice to talk to another Hugh.
I look at your career and everything that you've done, and I'm baffled by where you even start. But seeing that we're 50 years from, some would say, the great crime that was committed against the people of West Papua, when they were given an opportunity, so it seemed, to decide whether they were going to vote for independence or not. And in the end, they wound up getting absorbed into Indonesia. It's still a sore point for both countries. You were one of the very few people on the ground. I know you've been talking about that in recent days. What happened and what were you doing there?
Well, I went to London and worked for the London Daily Mirror and then got a job at Reuters. And eventually they sent me to Vietnam as a war correspondent, and then to Singapore as a correspondent, then to Indonesia in 69. And when I got there, the most interesting thing that was happening was there was going to be an act of free choice by the 800,000 Papuans in the western half of New Guinea, the old Dutch New Guinea, to decide if they wanted to go alone or be part of Indonesia. And people don't realise now that Holland and Indonesia were going to war over it, because Sukarno said everything that was Dutch is ours. And they said, look, you can have everything else, but you can't have the Stone Age people of Papua. We're looking after them. And they sent out an aircraft carrier. So in order to get peace, and because there was a mountain of gold in West Papua, the Americans stepped in and said, look, let's get the UN involved and we'll hold an act of free choice in 7 years' time. And in the meantime, Indonesia can administer the place. So I arrived when the act of free choice was going to be on in a few months' time. And then I found out they dropped 800 paratroopers in 3 months before into Enneratali in the Whistle Lakes. And you know, West Papua is the size of France. And it's, you know, I sent my stories out from Jakarta in those days. Reuters were the masters of communication, but my stories all went out in Morse code in 1969. So I went over there for 6 weeks, and President Nixon, I'm sure it was deliberate, he toured Southeast Asia at the same time as the Act of Free Choice was on. So all the correspondents, they all departed their posts in Bangkok or Hong Kong, Taiwan. They all came to preview the Act of Free Choice in May, but none of them came for the Act of Free Choice, because everyone was told, stay at home, the President of the United States is coming to you. And I was actually told, you know, you've got to stay there, we're coming to help you, you organise communication. If the President trips over, the stock exchange collapses. But anyway, I left. As soon as I got the message to stay, I left and I went over there because I wanted to see how it was done.
What did the actual vote entail? What did it look like?
It wasn't one man, one vote, and it wasn't a secret ballot. It was 1,025 selected men would vote in each of the province capitals, about 130 in each, and they would have to either put their hand up or stand up for Indonesia. And they were surrounded by Indonesian soldiers and people outside who yelled out, Sendiri, Sendiri, was picked up and thrown in the back of trucks. And so I took a picture and I just happened to get it as the big Indonesian army bloke in civilian clothes punched this Papuan in the jaw, and a policeman at the same time was hitting him over the head with a baton. And that stirred people up a bit in Australia.
So that was the act of free choice, wasn't
it?
That
was the act of free choice, yeah. And I went and saw how they selected the people, and there were 300 Papuans and Biak in a crowd, and lots of Indonesian army people there, and the 4 United Nations representatives who had been there for a year administering, watching this. And the Indonesians said, now we're going to send our men into the... And the crowd was sullen and angry, and they couldn't do anything. And they sent soldiers in dressed as civilians, into the crowd. And they brought six men out to the front, and they stood there and they said, these are the six you selected. And they looked like condemned men.
So 50 years on, West Papua remains Indonesian, yes. And they control it.
Well, it's part of Indonesia. Every school child in Indonesia sings a song. Indonesia stretches from Sabang to Merauke, and Merauke is on the Papua New Guinea border with West Papua.
I'm going to just move it forward from there because there's a bit of territory to cover. You spent so many years where you were travelling through Asia, you went to London, you were there in Southeast Asia, you were having these extraordinary experiences, you went to the war in Vietnam. You came back to Queensland. It must have been a remarkable decompression to be travelling all over the world and then be back where you'd started, basically, in very much deeply suburban Brisbane.
Well, I was amazed because I came back after 7 years and I found people knew absolutely nothing about the Vietnam War. They all thought America was winning and they were so powerful they would easily win. And when I told people that was incorrect, the trouble is that everyone thinks they know everything. And they told me where I was wrong. I was asked to speak to a liberal group at Salisbury one night by the local member who was interested in what I had to say. And they got really angry with me because I was saying it's all hopeless and the Americans can never win. Because I'd been all over Vietnam, you know, Rak Sia, Bam Me to it. The thing about a journalist, as you would know, Hugh, is that the soldier sits in the one spot in the jungle, but you go everywhere, something's happening.
And you'd been there in 1968. In fact, the year that made you, as you've chosen it, is 1968, which, of course, is the year of the Tet Offensive. You wrote about that. You wrote bestsellers about that year and what it meant. You saw it as being the moment when the war was lost, essentially. Did you go through a passage from being optimistic about our involvement and the American involvement to pessimistic?
Well, one of the reasons Reuters in London sent me to cover the war was that a lot of young journalists asked to go and wanted to go, and I wasn't interested at all. And so they sent me, and I arrived as a young bloke from Queensland thinking, well, the Yanks will clean this lot up in a hurry. But as I went out into the field, you don't know who is your enemy and who is your friend. And as it turns out in my book, the Time magazine correspondent in the building next to Reuters, Pham Du An, I found out after the war, when my Vietnamese friend came to Australia, was all the time a Viet Cong colonel, Colonel An. After the war, he was promoted to general. And while his picture was in Time magazine in May 69, it was also on the front page of a Hanoi newspaper with Uncle Ho, Ho Chi Minh, and it said, Viet Cong hero in the South, Pham Du An. And we dealt with him every week.
And so was there a moment in that where you went from your somewhat naive, kind of uneducated view of it, where was there a particular moment where you went, you know what, I've got this entirely wrong, we're losing this?
Yeah, well, I suppose it built up, really, Hugh. When I was getting shot at or personally artilleryed, I thought they're not doing too well. And I think it was the Hiep Duc Valley. The North Vietnamese built a four-lane highway down the Hiep Duc Valley in South Vietnam, and Americans would bomb it, but bombs are pretty useless, I found. They kill people if they land on top of you, but they would quickly repair the road. And the journalists wanted to get at the American armed forces. They would say, when are you going to the Hiep Duc Valley? And they'd say, are you coming with us? And anyway, when they went in, Bruce Piggott, who got killed, my roommate, he was an Australian from Melbourne, age 23, he went in, and his story, he wrote a great story, but it said American helicopters were shot out of the sky like gas-filled balloons here when they went into the Hiep Duc Valley today. But unfortunately, the rules of reporting the war, to stop their troops being in trouble, they could tell you couldn't publish that. So they said, you can only release 15 helicopters, otherwise it puts the troops on the ground. So Reuters put out a story that 15, so they could no longer say shot out of the sky like gas-filled balloons. Then they released the next 15 the next day and the next 15 the next day. And by that time, sub-editors all over the world were saying, not those bloody 15 helicopters again. But it was 45 helicopters, in fact.
So they were censoring the news, and consequently, people at home can hardly be blamed for being poorly informed.
Well, I think the news was generally uncensored, but there were occasions, and I could understand why, when you're out in the field, that you don't want to tell the people who are shooting at you that you've run out of ammo or you're ready to be run over. You know, lots of journalists risked their lives and gave their lives to tell the true story, but you couldn't get anywhere if you weren't accredited. You had to have a card, like to get into the ABC now, you need a card. And if you broke one of those rules, you were no longer accredited. So you depended on the Americans to let you on their helicopters and planes and to basically protect you. And they were very open. And the Americans, I mean, Australia is not like that at all. But the Americans are very open. And I was surprised how they tried to twist the news in their favour. But they, generally speaking, people got the news. But then by the time it got to Australia, it didn't get published in the newspapers here exactly the same as we sent it. For example, Jim Pringle wrote a story, another Reuters guy in the office, great Scottish reporter. The Americans had a victory in the Mekong Delta. It was the only victory they ever had in the Mekong Delta. They killed 180 Viet Cong guerrillas, and Pringle went down. He was a great writer, and the American military hated him because he used to nail them. Everyone wrote the usual story. 180 Viet Cong guerrillas have been killed in one of the biggest battles ever in the Mekong Delta. High-flying helicopter gunships flying out of sight and out of sound, firing their six-barrel Gatling guns. The usual story. Jim Pringle's story started, Viet Cong child soldiers lay like broken dolls along this canal today. And an American sergeant said, if they're old enough to pull a trigger, they're old enough to die. Well, when that got to Australia, AAP didn't put it out. When I came back shortly afterwards, I asked them why, and they said the AP and UPI stories were better for radio. 180 have been killed in one of the biggest battles ever, da-da-da-da.
It's funny because one of the reviews of an American review of one of your books said he has written truly about the Vietnam War. Even the lies are true. And
yes,
a little sense of that comes through in that story. I'd love to talk about the Vietnam War with you. It's such, still to this day, such a fascinating example of cost and folly.
Yes.
And good intentions in some ways that went awry.
That's
but tell
true.
Me about a few other things. There's so much else to talk about. Sir Joe Bjelke-Petersen, when you came back, was rising to his power. I mean, long before Trump, there was Sir Joe Bjelke-Petersen.
Yes, that's right.
What was he like? Should he have gone to jail, in your view?
I suppose from what came out in the Fitzgerald inquiry, he was found not guilty by a jury, but they later found out that there was a National Party president, Young Nationals, on the jury. But I can't make a judgment like that, Hugh. But I would say that personally, he was very nice and he would never avoid journalists or the questions, and he would always answer the question in his own unique way.
So you couldn't always understand the answer, but he always had an answer for you.
He'd say, I'm not going backwards in any direction, or, you know, you've got one foot on either side of a barbed wire fence. He had that, you know, he grew up in a cow bale by himself for 15 years, clearing land with some horses. And I remember his staff shuddered one day when he said, the hardest thing I ever had to do was shoot those horses that worked so hard for me. But, you know, he was of his time, but it was the Bjelke-mander, which actually the gerrymander existed before him under Labor, so both sides are equally guilty. He had 19% of the vote, and then you had that crazy campaign, which was headed by my boss, the editor-in-chief of The Australian, Les Hollings. I only found out when he died, they put it in his obituary in The Australian. He kept telling me, Joe's going to run for Prime Minister, and this is one of the reasons I ended up leaving. And I said, no, he's not. And he got really angry with me. And he said, write the story. And I said, no, he only gets 2.5% of the Australian vote, Les. And it turned out when he died, they said Les Hollings was behind the Joe for Canberra push.
Wow. all kinds of agendas. It's funny because looking back over everything you've done, the Vietnam War, your stuff in Jakarta, going into China, talking way across the border into communist China, everything you've done domestically, you know, there's a picture of you I have in my mind of you with a sort of a khaki shirt. It looks hot and sweaty and you're pounding it all out on a portable Olivetti. You talk about sending back stories by Morse code.
That's right.
And sometimes you think that kind of journalism is all over, and then you see work being done by Louise Milligan or Sophie McNeil or Adam Harvey and so on.
Yeah.
If you're starting again, would you do it again?
I don't know, but I wouldn't advise anyone to go and become a war correspondent, because particularly in a war in someone else's country, because you don't know if the bloke sitting at the typewriter next to you is a Viet Cong or not. And I was pretty safe in West Papua because I was the Reuters correspondent, and they would have loved to shoot me, but they didn't.
They didn't want the paperwork. Your life has been not just war. It's been fabulous best-selling memoirs about your childhood, Over the Top with Jim, still the best-selling Australian childhood memoir to this day. And also you had, and people in the southern states will forgive me for this, you had a key role in the State of Origin, the greatest gladiatorial combat that we see every year in Australian sport. Just fill us in on your key role in getting up this remarkable event.
Okay, well, interstate football between New South Wales and Queensland started in 1908. And when I was a young boy in 1950 or 49, I used to go to the Gabba to watch us play, and we always got beaten. We got thrashed. And then I went overseas for 7 years, and when I came back, I had a Norwegian girlfriend. I said, you've got to see one thing in Australia. She wanted to know about our culture. I said, I'll take you to Lang Park. And when I got there, there were 10,000 people outside trying to get in, and it was full. But we got thrashed again. And because once New South Wales got poker machines, they bought our best players. And the worst thing was that not only did they select their best players in their team, they selected our best players. So we got thrashed every year. Often 4-0, it was four matches a year, then 4-0, 4-0, 4-0, 4-0. By the time of Origin, we'd lost for 21 years in succession. And, you know, which everyone raved on about, the American baseball team didn't win for 100 years, but there were 31 teams in the competition. There were two teams in this competition, us and them. And anyway, I won the best sporting feature in 1979 for the National Press Club, and they flew me down to get the prize at the National Press Club. And at the same time, a headhunter rang me up and said, Malcolm Fraser wants you to write his speeches. And I said, Malcolm Fraser is the worst speaker I've ever heard. And they said, well, isn't that more of a challenge for you? And I said, no, I'm not interested. And of course, they get paid on how many people they get to turn up, I think. So they said, look, you'll be flying down first class. I said, I'm going down. And they said, first class? I said, no. And they said, well, you'll be flying down. And I thought, well, I'll just go and hear what he has to say, and I can tell my grandchildren the Prime Minister tried to hire me. But when I got there, Eggleton was on one side and Fraser was on the other, and they wouldn't take no for an answer. Anyway, in the end, they realised I didn't want the job. On the way down on the plane, I sat next to a bloke who went to the same school as me, St. Joseph's College, Gregory Terrace, and he was an orphan. He was adopted twice as a baby and as the youngest of nine, and he grew up to become a senator and a debating champion. And he became president of the QRL on the ticket that I will defeat New South Wales. And so I'd interviewed him a few times about this. And he was 1A and I was in 1B. And I said, Ron. And he said, Hugh, why are you going to Canberra? And I thought, I better not tell him, he's Labor senator, that the Liberal Prime Minister wants to hire me. So I said, I'm going down to get a prize. And he said, not for that story you wrote on the Queensland Rugby Union team. And I said, oh, yeah. And he said, they're killing us. They're taking our crowd. They're playing as a club team. And I said, well, Ron, you've got a problem. You're losing all the time. I said, I had the whole outer to myself this year. And 10 years ago, I couldn't get in. And I said, you've got to bring our players back to play for us. And he said, we've been over that ground a dozen times. We can't do it. The New South Wales clubs won't release them because they say they don't want their players injured playing for us. And he said, anyway, I don't want to reward players with our precious maroon jersey who leave us. And if I do, what's going to keep our new young stars coming through? Like, we've got some great players like young Wally Lewis and Mal Meninga coming through. What will keep them here? And I said, yeah, but the next year they'll be playing for New South Wales. Finally, he took off his glasses and breathed on them and cleaned them. And I knew something was coming from a debating champion. And he said, Hugh, I wouldn't say this to anyone else, and I'd never say it to them, but what if we lose? He said, if we've been telling people here for decades that if we had our best players back, we'd win. But what if we didn't win? And I said, gee, that's a good point. I never thought of that. He said, would they really try? And I came up with my best line. I said, Ron, Queenslanders are like Catholics. There's no such thing as an ex-Queenslander. There's only lapsed Queenslanders. And he leapt out of his seat and he said, by God, you're right.
And with that, the game was changed. And if you started off in Queensland, you got to play for Queensland.
That's right.
State of origin. And it's been an absolute a Goliath of a sporting event every year since.
It has
generated millions of dollars, and the Queenslanders have won it far too often, in my view. But there you have it.
Well, Ron invited me to sit next to him for the first match and to his boardroom behind the seats for a dinner. And the governor came to dinner and the deputy premier, not Joe, he wouldn't come. And so I was privileged to that extent.
Your year is 1968, the year that made you.
Yes.
Did it actually make you?
Yes, it did. It changed me completely, I think. I learnt how to write a story much better than I knew beforehand. And I learnt, don't believe what everyone tells you. And I learnt to write what I saw. So, for example, the Americans went into the demilitarised zone, a battalion of Marines. The demilitarised zone was a six-mile strip that divided North Vietnam from South Vietnam, and there was supposed to be nobody in there. But the North Vietnamese were always in there shelling the Americans. So they went in, quote, to show the southern half of the DMZ is ours, that we can go in any time we want, any place we want. Anyway, they got ambushed on the way out. And so myself and Dana Stone, who got killed, a great photographer, and Tom Corpora, we met them as they came out. And I interviewed a black American, and I told him what they said, the general had said, and he said, going in's all right, man. It's getting out that's a trouble. And they were so angry that when Dana went to take pictures of all their dead, they raised their rifles and wanted to shoot him.
Going in is all right. It's getting out that is the trouble. That is the whole Vietnam War, isn't it?
That's it. You summed it up. And I, instead of writing that 45 Americans were killed and 56 were shot, what I'd learnt watching Pringle and the famous American writers, I wrote, the American Marines came out of the demilitarised zone today carrying their dead piled high on their tanks.
And even now, over 50 years later, it sounds like that's a memory for you.
It is.
Yeah, it's funny. You say the year that made you, they're the years that destroy us as well in a certain way.
Yeah, but I think I became a much better journalist for it. It made me unpopular in Brisbane, and lots of journalists really disliked me for some reason. I was used to everyone liking me. What I learnt with the Americans was, because they filed through our office and I saw their stories on our telexes, and they gave their own opinion of what was happening, and no one in Australia did that. I remember Bill Toohey, a famous war correspondent, wrote, the Americans say the journalists are saying we're losing the war because they're only seeing pinpricks and they're not seeing the big picture. And he said, well, I've been here for 2 years and the big picture is dangerously out of focus. And so I was willing to inject what I thought into a story. And I didn't say this reporter or your they use all sorts of funny things. I just said, I think Joe's going to win the election because he's only got to get 90% of the vote.
Hmm. It's great to talk to you, Hugh Lunn.
It's great to talk to another proper journalist. I think there are many proper journalists, but there are many people who don't deserve to be called journalists.
Well, it's very nice to put me in that company, Hugh. The song from 1968 was a song you listened to in Vietnam. We kind of assume everyone was listening to, you know, The Doors or something or other, but your musical tastes were more upbeat in many ways.
Well, it wasn't exactly upbeat. It was that I shared a room with two other Reuters correspondents, and one of them, there was nothing, no television for us to watch, or there was only Radio America, Good Morning and all that sort of stuff, Good Morning Vietnam. And Jim Pringle had a little portable record player, but he only had one record, and it was the Supremes. And so when often one was in Da Nang and one was in Con Tien and one was in Khe San and one was in, and if I was in Saigon, I'd sit there listening to the Supremes.
We'll hear from 1968, the music you were listening to in Vietnam as you were learning the hard way what the war there might be all about, the Supremes with Baby Love. Hugh Lunn, so great to talk to you.
I'd love to hear it again. Thanks, Hugh.
Such a cheerful song, doesn't it, against the backdrop of the Vietnam War, Baby Love by the Supremes, the song chosen by my guest for the year that made me, Hugh Lunn.